Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel Harrison, joined as always by my co-host here, David Taylor. And this morning, some news on the Twitters and Facebook that the head of RZIM, Ravi Zacharias, passed away. Rest his soul and may light perpetual shine upon him. Now, Ravi Zacharias, Dave, as I understand it, was a bit of a seminal figure in your youth. This made me think about figures of our youth that we have in our past but aren't necessarily looming large now.
Yeah, like I think Ravi Zacharias is probably responsible for me getting into philosophy and doing, you know, 2 degrees and thinking about these kinds of things. Like he was, you know, because he was an evangelical, but he was not the type of evangelical that I was used to, in that he was interested in engaging with philosophers and interesting figures from intellectual history and things like that. And he was my introduction to people like Nietzsche and Sartre and all these people. You know, to be honest, I ended up kind of probably
moving
away from him. But at the same time, I was like, you know, I have to kind of acknowledge that. Oh, yeah, like he was really important in that sense for me as this kind of gateway into this whole intellectual world. So, yeah.
It did make me wonder about figures who loomed so large in a certain period of your life.
Yeah.
That now, you know, just do not. And I was trying to think through who would this be for me. I mean, there was a time in my life where I read everything that Tom Wright wrote, or N.T. Wright.
Yeah, that was someone for me as well, yeah.
And that's not to say I wouldn't enjoy reading something now. Mm. It was like a phase of my life in which, and I think it was because there was a sort of, there's these inflection points almost in your life, isn't there? So for me, reading Surprised by Hope, for example, coming out of a Pentecostal background, you know, that idea that actually the world matters and the renewal of it matters,
yeah,
as opposed to something that is so, you know, hyper-spiritualized that it's sort of beyond the world itself.
Yep.
And actually getting back to that sort of fundamental narrative that he provides in that book was, you know, sort of, even though I remember very little of it now, you could kind of identify a point in time in which that was an important thing.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, N.T. Wright was really important for me for that reason as well. But also, I think I still basically read Paul and the Gospels through N.T. Wright's scholarship. Like, that's how I interpret those things. I don't have the expertise to know whether that's right or not.
Oh,
it's just that,
yeah,
that's the schema that I use.
I was thinking about other ones. I once got taken to, so this is not someone that was influential in my life, but it is amusing. So you went to a Ravi Zacharias event, right? I once got taken to a Joyce Meyer event.
Oh, really? Sarah's mum was really into Joyce Meyer.
Oh, man. It was everything that dreams are made of. It was just like, they had this interview with her husband at first, and he was just so awkward, just the epitome of, I just want to be the backstage guy.
Yeah.
And then—
He was your kind of blueprint, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, a ministry husband. Yeah. That's right. And then they gave out gift bags to all the ladies, and I got nothing.
Yeah.
I got nothing, which was just like, what's up with that?
So,
you know,
when I was in high school, and late primary school, my friends were either from a Reformed background, Reformed evangelical background, or from a Pentecostal background. And the Pentecostal people that I knew talked about Joyce Meyer. And I didn't know who that was, but there was someone on Australian TV. There was a retail shop called Joyce Meyer's. And I, not Joyce Meyer, there was some.
The shop's called Meyer.
No. What's the shop? Someone remind me. It's a furniture shop. And I thought they were talking about that person. I'm like, oh, that furniture magnate is a thing.
That makes total sense though, in the health and wealth prosperity gospel context, right? That people would be following this furniture magnate.
So another person actually would have been C.S. Lewis actually for me. So
but C.S. Lewis, you still.
Yeah, but so I went for a long time going, like thinking that he was basically irrelevant, you know, for quite a few years. So I got really into him very young. And basically it was just this, which thing, it's a thing that religious folk often do. They latch onto someone just because they're of their prestige, really. They go, oh, there's, here's a real intellectual on my side. And that's kind of why I embraced him. But I remember getting a lot out of him, especially Screwtape Letters. But then I rediscovered him basically in the last 12 months and realized, oh, actually, this is a very fascinating thinker who has a lot of really, really powerful things to say. And yeah, we might be looking at one of his works a bit later on.
Yeah, it'd just be really interesting to think if you could go back and find implicitly in people's writing. I mean, there's always something about this when you write something that things implicitly lurk in the background that you've forgotten, right? So, you know, I've just written this book and certain figures in some ways loom large, but they're hardly cited. So someone like Stanley Hauerwas in some ways always lurks in the background of someone like John Milbank, right? Even though they're quite different, there's clearly like an antecedent of some thought that comes from there, but you know, they sort of lurk there. So it's almost, you know, if you're writing, is Ravi going to be lurking? If I'm writing, is it going to be about, you know, Joyce Meyer's prosperity gospel?
Yeah. I mean,
no, I went to one event, I was taken to it, I thought it was weird.
Francis Schaeffer would be another person for me. Although I have looked at some of his arguments since and gone, oh gosh. I bet I used these in essays as an undergraduate, and like my tutors probably would have been embarrassed by them a little bit.
Well, yeah. If you produced an argument, that's the first step for an undergraduate. So well done. I mean, I think one of the problems is that we recognize that some of these thinkers, when we come to look at them later, they were also quite embedded in a certain kind of, what would you say, right-wing negative liberty politics, right?
And reactionary.
And free marketeers and things like this. Yep. And so it becomes kind of an interesting sort of, how do you mediate and negotiate that? But anyway, what we are talking about today, this is not entirely just a, and it is a giant preface, but it does flow seamlessly into what we're actually discussing, because we're looking today at William Kavanagh's very excellent article, Killing for the Telephone Company, Why the Nation State is Not the Keeper of the Common Good. And what we're interested in here is Kavanagh and his understanding, especially of the state. Now, why are we going to discuss this thinker, William Kavanagh, who's the professor of theology at DePaul University in Chicago? Now, we're discussing him in part because we both really, really like his work. We think he's an excellent writer and he's got excellent ideas. And we've discussed him previously, actually, when we looked at consumerism. Mm. And we were reflecting on his book, Being Consumed, which is just a wonderful book for reflecting on Christian ethics in a consumer society.
And I think basically most things that I've said on this podcast have probably been modifications of his arguments. It's either him or Rowan Williams.
So he is one of those thinkers that lurks in the background. Yep. If you shell out the stupid amounts of money that'll cost you to read my book, you'll see his name is sort of peppered throughout it, right? Even though there are points at which I disagree with him. His book, Myth of Religious Violence, is, again, a phenomenal work. This essay, Killing for the Telephone Company, was first an article and then it's reproduced in his collection of essays, Migrations of the Holy. So he's fundamentally, William Kavanagh, you can say, is fundamentally critical of attempts to baptize a state as the site of Christian politics. For some people, he may be something of a second Bible if you're an anarchist Christian or anarchist Catholic in particular, or if you're an Anabaptist of certain kinds, because Kavanagh, of course, was also a student of Stanley Hauerwas. I think this argument that he puts forward around the baptism of the state as a site of Christian politics, I think it raises very important and I think in many ways correct concerns. Now, I'm going to argue in this, and Dave may push back a little bit on this because he's more enamored with the pure anarchism. I think he becomes a little too limited, Kavanagh, sometimes in his thinking. He ends up, I think, with too negative a refusal of the possibility of statecraft, or to put it more benignly, the role of civil authority as part of a Christian politics. And indeed, how actually engaging with that civil authority, I think, may be necessary and indeed maybe inevitable. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set out this article, the argument within it, and then we're going to raise some critical questions and see where we go. Now, the article itself As I say to my students, if you, pause the lecture, go listen to it. No. Obviously, we're just going to give a rundown of it, so you don't actually have to read it. That's part of our hope to present it in this podcast. But if you do want to read it, as I said, it's in the, it's reproduced in the book Migrations of the Holy. If you have a university account, you could find it as well. And I think Nathan Campbell also posted a link to a copy of it on our Facebook page as well. So you can read it if you wish, but we're going to set out some of its core arguments. So we can begin, I think, with its title, Killing for the Telephone Company. And this is obviously referring to the exercising your killing power, as in going to war for and killing others, for the state, which is aligned with a telephone company. Now, this is a quote that Kavanagh takes from Alistair MacIntyre. And I'm going to read out the entire quote from MacIntyre because it's quite beautiful and quite interesting. So MacIntyre says, "The modern nation state, in whatever guise, is a dangerous and unmanageable institution, presenting itself on the one hand as a bureaucratic supplier of goods and services, which is always about to, but never actually does, give its clients value for money, and on the other, as a repository of sacred values, which from time to time invites one to lay down one's life on its behalf. It's like being asked to die for the telephone company." Hmm. So that there basically summarizes Dave's politics. Is that fair?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Like, it captures something of it, right?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. So the state is this impersonal superstructure that flattens out everyone's identity to that of consumer, and while at the same time purporting to be the kind of focal point for and informer of our common affections and bonds of love.
Right. You know. So MacIntyre and then Kavanagh following him discuss how politics classically consisted in the rational deliberation of what is our common good. Mm. So our common good here being something like what is necessary, what goods pertain to, a life together that pursues true human ends or mutual human flourishing towards an end like solidarity or charity or love. And this, of course, was classically understood in terms of our ultimate end, a life with God. So how politics was a deliberation towards the goods needed to pursue that end. Now, for MacIntyre and Kavanagh following him, this classical understanding cannot take place within our modern nation states. In part, this is simply an argument of size. They argue that the size of our modern nation states precludes rational deliberation towards our common good. But more fundamentally, I think, the inability of the state to be the guardian of the common good arises from what they see as the constitution of the modern nation state, as Dave just discussed. Mm. MacIntyre points to it, the state, this is, as merely dispensing goods. We can think goods like liberty, and then also asking us to die for it. So it's apparently then the embodiment of unity and collective purpose as witnessed in its call for us to die for it.
Yeah.
So Kavanagh's main objection then in this article is he's arguing against any contention the state in some essential form is tasked with protecting this common good. And this leads him to an eventual conclusion that we could recognize how the state may sometimes secure some goods. We're not opposed to education, for example. We're not opposed to controlling violence, for example, to allow people to live undisturbed lives. And we may engage with this, Kavanagh says, but we should in an ad hoc way where those goods can be obtained. Mm. We must rather, as a primary project, he says, demystify the state. That is, to treat it more like a telephone company rather than something we would die for. And indeed, he thinks the state has become then a parodic, that is a parody of, the body of Christ. It purports to be the thing through which we all cohere. We come together in unity. But in its own characterization, as he characterizes the state, it's actually anti the body of Christ. Mm. It becomes an idol, which draws away our loyalty, especially eventually in its demand that we kill in its name. Mm. So he argues then we must instead be creating alternative spaces that are independent from the state, market, individual paradigm. Now, to my mind, his argument is essentially right in many respects of its characterization, but I think there are differences to my mind, what I would take to be the conclusions or where we go from that and what is possible. So I thought it'd be a good idea to just dig deeper down into his actual argument and then raise those critical questions. Mm. His first and primary point around the modern nation state is precisely that it is modern. It's a modern thing. So it's not like Aristotle's polis, where Aristotle thought the political society was established to achieve some common end or the happiness of its people. It's not like Aquinas' understanding of a political society either, which political authority governed through natural law and aided different men and women in virtue towards their ultimate end. That classical and Middle Ages tradition, he says, is not available to us essentially with our nation state. What we get instead on Kavanagh's account is the development of something quite new, something quite modern. Now, there's an interesting question there, I think, because neither Aristotle or Aquinas were just simply describing what they saw either. They were also trying to engage in an imaginative telling about what is good and true and should be the case. So why you can't engage in that sort of reflection or like Aristotle's or Aquinas's now is an interesting question. But for Kavanagh, the state is not natural or necessary then. This reflects a general constructivist approach in his work, right? So his Myth of Religious Violence analyzes the concepts of religion and secular and how they developed in modernity. And they're not just natural or necessary categories, but actually categories of power. Once you start categorizing things as religious, that is automatically placing in the basket of private, for example, and distinguished from secular authority. And so the claim that there is a category called religion is actually a claim to configure power in a certain way within the modern nation state.
And in his work, it explicitly was constructed to aid colonization as well. So if the state could monopolize public identity, if the state could privatize religion, that is what it means to be. He uses the example of India with the idea of Hindu. So Hindu just meant Indian. But if they could privatize being a Hindu to the private sphere, then the British Empire could claim the public identity of its subjects, its Indian subjects. So there was a distinction between public identity, which is a national identity, and private identity, which was your religious identity. That was a arbitrarily constructed, not arbitrarily, an insidiously constructed distinction or cynically constructed.
Yeah, and you get this obviously with Locke, where he says we must distinguish the just balance between church and state, right? Mm. Now, this is actually just because Locke starts trying to define what is religion is in its essential content. Mm. And it turns out to be, you know, something distinguished from politics. So Kavanagh's not interested in distinguishing religion from politics. He doesn't think that politics is some differentiated thing from religious endeavors in the sense of like what Christians do. But he's trying to create a different form of politics that is outside of nation state building, right? Because he thinks the nation state then in this construction approach, looking at historically, how did it arise? He essentially thinks arises in quite a sordid manner, right? Mm. It doesn't have particularly pristine and lovely origins, right?
It's generated through warfare, right?
That's right. So it's got the nation forms itself through both external enemies and internal consumption. So external enemies, it becomes bounded geographic spaces in which you define yourselves against an external enemy. You know, this is like Schmitt talking about the friend-enemy distinction. But then also internally, right? So secularization, the very word itself originally meant the appropriation of property from the churches to the state, right? And this is what the state did. It took over authority and power and property from churches, from villages, from localities, from cities, from different
princedoms. And local lords and things like that, estate holders.
Right. And then it becomes like the single source of authority. So it's allied with a new conception of sovereignty. Yep.
And in Kavanagh's account, right, part of the argument is that it makes it simpler to extract revenue from the population. So it's no longer mediated through estate holders or local feudal lords. The king can raise armies and taxes seamlessly. And the driving force behind that was the need to wage war.
Wage war, that's right. And you still get this now, right? So he has this interesting discussion in the essay about how nations conflate different interests. So, you know, labor and capital becomes one under the banner of America. And this is why you see, you know, the bailouts for corporate interests during the financial crisis are framed as for the American interest, right? When in reality, they help certain propertied interests, right? So the nation state is,
businesses aren't registered in America.
and actually explicitly encouraged to not be registered in America as well. So it's both this, the state arises both through appropriation internally and also defining against external enemies. And principally, as you're saying, through this means of war. And so he frames this, and this is the subject of the collection of essays, as a migration of the holy. Because religion, he says, doesn't disappear, although the church is privatized. Rather, he says, the understanding of the sacred or what is holy shifts to the newly formed nation state. Mm. In which it is now the state that we're prepared to die for and the state that demands our public devotion. And this is particularly the case you see in the United States where he's, you'll see him through religious violence, for example, he talks often about flag devotion, in which it's a form of blood sacrifice. Yep. You know, the perpetual wars that take place and the persons that must die in order to renew a sense of the nation's purpose.
Yep.
Right. And this is, you know, he raised the question, why is that not perceived as religion?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, all the various things of Christianity and so on are cast as religion.
And it's an immensely important point, right? So if you look at the controversy, like we don't have this, we have some controversy around the flag in Australia, but in the United States, when you look at the kind of protests against standing for the national anthem or paying respect to the flag, it's always cast as a disrespect of the military class. It's not a disrespect of the common good for which the nation stands. It is the military industrial complex that, or the representatives of that it is interpreted that you are slighting by not paying homage. So that connection between warfare and I don't want to call it patriotism. I think patriotism isn't the same as
nation building or nationalism.
Nationalism, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and this is an interesting point because I think when I read Kavanagh, I gain so much out of it and I find it invigorating and so on. But I do pause at times and think, you know, this strikes me as American often. Like the criticism is very much, if I lived in the United States, I think I'd be much more in line with everything he says.
Yeah.
When you actually have this sort of sense of perpetual war that galvanizes and creates the coherence for the nation itself, right? This blood sacrifice that takes place in the name of ultimately some conception of negative liberty or some sort of, some notion of freedom.
But you have a way out because you can just say, well, I'm a subject of the Queen.
What? This is hilarious, actually. Because the last time he was in Australia, so he's been here a few times, and last time he was here, and I've spoken at things with him, and last time when we were having dinner afterwards, I tried to convince him that all of America's woes would fall away if they just came back to Her Majesty.
But there's something in that, right?
I did frame it in constitutional terms around, you know, the way we do Westminster Parliament as opposed to the American separation of powers around president and the Houses of Congress. Mm. And I was talking this through and so on. And I think by the end of it, he got a little bit wary of me. He said two things. One was he said when I started talking about the Queen, he's sounding a little bit like Milbank. And then he said the other thing he started talking about was all the Irish Catholic names he gave his children. So I was like, all right, so there we go. And so the Irish Catholic sort of starts sort of rebelling against this notion of, you know, well, have you considered the Queen? but I was trying. I was raising with him as well that there are differences, I think, between our different countries and the self-understanding that they have. You know, whether, for example, in the United States, a lot of this argument makes sense because you have a much more of a sense that it's very difficult to talk about public goods in America. You know, when I lived there...
I saw someone on Twitter accusing any common good argument of being fascistic.
Yeah, exactly. So there's all this debate going on because of Adrian Vermeule's essay in The Atlantic on common good constitutionalism, right?
Yep.
But just to try and make it in a concrete example, when I was living there, they were talking about Obamacare, you know, the healthcare. And it seemed very clear to me that those on the sort of progressive left, the reason why they were interested in healthcare is so that people could perhaps maybe reach the potential of being like a expressive individual like they are.
Mm.
Right. There wasn't a sense in like, there's not a deeply rooted sense in the United States that health may be a good that is public and we should all be invested in. There's not really that sense of a common wheel around common spaces, maybe,
yeah.
Or maybe a little bit. But, you know, it's got much more of a narrative of the self-made man.
Yeah, right? That's
who's
right.
Trying to like make their way in the world.
Sorry, what's that young adult author, John Green, is it? Who had that really, still has that really popular YouTube channel. I remember seeing him, he talks a lot about, he's a classic kind of Bill Gates liberal type. One of the things he always talks about is how we should really get behind public education because basically we don't want to live in a society of uneducated people.
Because they might rise up in a revolt.
Oh, no, just because, you know, it's insufferable to live amongst
okay.
uneducated people. But also like that it gives, it's almost like an argument that having a more educated populace gives us more consumer choice because we've got more productive people.
Yeah, right.
And it's that kind of thing rather than saying, well, this is no, like education is humanizing.
And you get a much more starker division between, you know, the 10% who enlist their kids in daycare programs that are feeder schools for Ivy League, you know, and this sort of stuff, right? Australia has echoes of that. Like it definitely does. That's my impression since moving here. But we still have much more of a sense of like, no, public education is a good and it can be an avenue towards, you know, flourishing of the person and things like this, right? So there's always a question, I think, when I'm reading Kavanagh and other authors as well, like someone like Stanley Hauerwas especially, about how much and how far this translates into different democratic contexts like Australia or where I'm from, New Zealand originally and so on, and the United Kingdom. I think there's always a transatlantic divide. So Kavanagh, for example, is influenced by radical orthodoxy thinkers like John Milbank, but they clearly divide in terms of these, Milbank would clearly argue that the civil authority is a dual partner in protecting and advancing the common good, although it is one that must be cognizant of the exhortations and the body of Christ and so on. So that seems to be much more of a British way of thinking, right? Where you do have establishment, you do have a sense that the church and its institutions are embedded into what some people call a concurrent jurisdiction to deal with marriages, to deal with education, to deal with things like this. Whereas the United States does start off as a more kind of, you know, that melting pot, that sense of like 1,000 flowers may bloom and we'll just try and manage this competitive disorder, right?
Yeah.
So there is a difference, I think, that you have to kind of, and think about, you know, is Australia, sometimes people call it Washminster, right? You know, it's part Washington, part the United Kingdom, part Westminster. And do we have elements of both?
But I suppose this might be showing my ignorance a bit, but wouldn't part of the issue there be that in the United States, the fight for centralization is much more, needs to be much more energetic because there is kind of competing jurisdictions in a way that doesn't exist within, say, the United Kingdom and Australia in the same way. So like that, America's a strange place, right? Because
you're getting into a complex history, right? So, you know, there is in all our countries a centralizing of fiscal power, although you look at something like the coronavirus at the moment, it shows that fiscal power is actually being exercised quite a lot by our states.
Yep.
And in the UK, you say it's more centralized, but then they actually have devolution. They do have their own versions of a kind of almost federalist notion.
Yeah, but.
And subsidiarity and localities and so on. This is actually something I don't think Kavanagh discusses, right?
Yeah.
So his understanding of the state is quite monochrome.
Mm.
It is this one sort of unified authority that consumes civil society. And I think that's got real truth to it.
Yep.
If you think about his discussion in this article about consuming civil society, right, you can think about how a lot of civil society groups are turned into service providers by the state. And when they're turned into service providers, they must cohere with what the state sets out its policies. Mm. So securitizations, they must go through big security checks, for example, or agree with, information gathering of their people who are participating in their programs, yep. things like that. So civil society groups do get consumed by the state. But I think there is still an argument to say, well, maybe we can think about power and the exercise of it in more complex ways. Federalism is more complex, you know, where power is exercised at multiple levels. Subsidiarity talk about, you know, again, exercising power at multiple levels and so on. And I think maybe Kavanaugh is quite skeptical of the possibilities of that. Mm. But to my mind, these are things that have, they've actually grown in some places. So in the United Kingdom, you do get more talk of this post-devolution, for example. Mm. I want to go back to...
Sure.
Because I think it's important to articulate one of his core concerns, right? So he, in another quite famous article, he talks about the state as an alternative soteriology, right? It is the state that saves us, he says, because the idea is that in liberal writers that we are in a war against all or that we are individuals that are trying to exercise our property rights, our expressive rights, our rights to self-determination, and we need a state as an authority to regulate, negotiate, and manage those things.
Yeah.
So the state, in that sense, saves us from this. At
and
one point
from
in this
religious,
article,
religious conflict as well, right?
Yeah, especially in when we're dealing with religious conflict, yep. right? So religion is privatized in the name of the unified public, right? And one point in this article, drawing from Charles Tilly, refers to the state as a protection racket. Mm. So here, his takeaway, you know, is that this bureaucratized invention, exercising unified law and so on, is not birthed out of concern for the common good, but empowering death. Now, I think there's bits to be critical of that we've gone over time, but we're going to keep going, aren't we?
Yeah,
so
sure.
There's a couple of things to be critical of in this article, and we've already raised a couple of points. But at one point, he starts discussing John Milbank's articulation of complex space, mm-hmm. right? Now, for Milbank, this is drawing from, you know, high Middle Ages thought and going back to classical ideas and or even Augustine, right, who talks about the city of God more like a commonwealth. A complex space for Milbank is about overlapping jurisdictions that mediate our social life in multiple contexts, local bodies, unions, universities, guilds, villages, confraternities, towns, and so on, right? And that contrasts for him simple space, which is about essentializing political life down to the individual and the state, with the state seen as furthering and preserving individual liberties. Mm-hmm. But the difficulty I find with this is that Kavanaugh appeals to this complex space as though this were just simply a historical matter, whereas Milbank's trying to argue for complex space now. And Kavanaugh also seems to say that, you know, our job is to create these alternative spaces, right, outside of this singular the state, the nation, and so on. Whereas for Milbank, with talking about complex space, he also means it as a complex space within an overall unity, a community of communities, as the social pluralists would say. So Milbank, for example, in his discussion of complex space, draws the image of a Gothic cathedral.
Yep.
Right, it's a building which we can endlessly add to, extend upon, new additions, be creative in filling in detail, but it's still a cathedral, right? It's still a body. And there's an idea here that what Milbank is saying is that all these different instances, these different communities, these different localities of authority, they're all still gathered together in a shared project. What is just? What is our common good that we are trying to have a conversation of over time? And this matters when you have complex space, I think, because those groups can conflict. They can rub up against each other. They can have instances where the supposed liberty of one conflicts with another. And so there has to be somewhere mediating between them. And mediating between them means, what is the goal? What are we trying to pursue? And that has within it a flavor of unity. It's not just about, you know, individual, or it's not just about groups that can flourish outside of this. And I don't think Kavanaugh would disagree, but I think you can take his thought in that direction of kind of almost, you know, a deracinated version of it would be Benedict option, you know, we're trying to say, let's create these alternative community spaces and that's our job. Mm-hmm. So you can think of that outside of any broader conception of how these groups cohere together or how they fit together.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that the state apparatus and the legal structures and those things that provide the structure necessary for the flourishing of those communities that have their own authority, et cetera, that superstructure is still important and necessary.
I think it's actually to engage with
ethically and theologically.
And I think it can be necessary in the sense that I don't think that you can have these flourishing communities when you deal, Kavanaugh points to the sheer extent of the administrative state, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think you can have these flourishing communities if our civil authorities are not committed to them.
Okay.
Right? If they're not committed to their flourishing, if they're not in some sense seeking to nourish them.
Yep.
So this is another problem I have with the article, because it says, it's against the idea that the state is a guardian of the common good.
Yep.
And in some ways I completely agree in the way, because I agree with how he's characterized the state, if that's all we have.
Yep.
But I think we can be more there's more room to be creative and think about, well, what is our civil authority? What can we imagine it to be?
Yep.
And then that means, I think, breaking apart the different claims as to people who would say the civil authority should be in part a guardian of the common good. So you could have like a right-wing version of that, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, the state is a guardian of the common good, and they just mean that as in it protects public order to ensure the liberty of individuals.
Yep.
Right? Now, that's not something that, if you listen to this podcast, we're particularly interested in. Mm-hmm. But, you can have this thought about differently. So Rowan Williams, in his preface to the collection of essays on Blue Labor, talks about how we need a different understanding of the state as nourishing what is already nourishing, mm-hmm. Supporting what is already supportive in the primary communities that make up society, mm-hmm. right? So it's not that I think, it's that you can actually try to think imaginatively about a civil authority that is concerned with the common good, but it's not a top-down, just simply top-down. Mm. It's not simply consuming civil society, but it's actually trying to promote and support that which is conducive to building a commonwealth.
Right. And so I guess the challenge there would be to... So I'm just trying to think through... So this makes complete sense to me, because I'm someone who is part of a church and a denomination and things like that. So I can understand the concept of I belong to a particular polis where we engage in deliberation together. We're formed by common values and things like that. But I'm trying to imagine what would my non-religious friends make of this, because they wouldn't seem to have any form of community apart from say, so the union might exist as one, but it's been so flattened out as an institution that it doesn't represent something like this anymore. In a strange way, sporting clubs seem to be an example of this. But I guess then the project would be generating these forms of community.
That's right.
So yeah. how do we do that?
Yeah, well, I don't think that can be done. Like, law is not your enemy necessarily, right?
Yep.
I don't think it can be done in the absence of it. So take a corporation. How do you build a mutualist corporation? Maybe it requires actually demanding that on corporate boards are worker representation. Mm. Maybe it demands incorporating into corporate constitutions a social purpose.
Yep.
Maybe it demands these sorts of things. Or, how do we support, local sports groups? How do we support unions? Well, actually, we support them through, current workplace laws. Mm. Only allow you to strike during a enterprise bargaining session. Things like this. So law is already there.
Yep.
And one of my concerns here is that this is a wonderful article and I agree with so much. But if you take some of the arguments through to where some people may want to take them, it kind of seems to potentially give up on a lot of what I'd call Christian constitutionalism, the reflections on political authority and law and how that is conducive to building the spaces and the orientation necessary for our common good, right? So, you know, you're saying about friends who are not part of various things. Well, they are part of different things. It's about how do we support them or not, right? How are those things supported? And you get it in different places, right? So, you know, neighborhood programs that you get specifically, you know, in the United Kingdom when they develop this in conjunction with the Church of England. You know, and then there's another thing about, you know, well, actually sometimes maybe it's a good thing that the overarching authority does something also.
Yep.
There are certain things that it should do. So we come from countries where post-World War II, there was an explosion in the welfare state.
Yep.
Now, that, I don't think, you know, you can, there's certain critical elements of that, but actually this is a good recognition of our fundamental solidarity with each other.
Yeah.
Right? And it's done through, and these are things that actually build.
But wouldn't a right-wing... response to that be that was only achieved through the appropriation of those things from the church?
Look, yes, so that's where the critical point would come in, right? That actually you can then simply turn the church into a service provider subordinated to the state, for example. And the church itself redirects its attention. So here's this great little vignette at the end of this article where he has a consultant who was hired by one of the dioceses in the Catholic Church in America to talk about elimination of poverty reduction in their state, and what strategy they should use. And this consultant said, you should just get every member of your diocese and you should send them on a boot camp in which they have to go and witness poverty. And they have to go and, you know, think about how they would engage with it. And he said that is the singularly best thing you could do for poverty reduction.
Yep.
And then the vignette continues by saying, I was fired. And then the bishop started a publicity campaign for lobbying the state government.
Yep.
And I think it's a brilliant, you know, vignette, right? And it captures a lot of what Kavanaugh is about and thinking about. But my reaction to it is also, why not both?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like not necessarily lobbying, but an understanding that you must be attentive to laws that create poverty, right? And how laws can be directed towards a common good or not.
Yep.
And at the same time, galvanizing your people to be the primary witness to that, right? We've said this before on this podcast, I think, about how political witness requires multiple layers, right? It can't be either or, it can't be this. And there's a final point on that, I think, about how laws can be or not oriented towards a common good. One thing I find, you know, that I actually draw from Kavanaugh's work is, you know, again, just the basic notion that you can't have neutral spaces.
Yep.
So his most recent writing at the moment is talking about idolatry, and Pope Francis especially discussing idolatry and how our economic systems are not the space empty of gods, but they're actually furnished by false gods, right? False gods of profit, false gods of wealth accumulation and so on, right? And so this makes me go, well, we don't actually, when we look at someone like Locke, he's not absent a conception of the common good. It's just he sees what is common as, you know, providing for the advancement of property.
Once the whole world was America.
Yeah, exactly. And the appropriating of that property, right? And like actually using this authority of the state to do so. So there's a kind of perverse understanding of the common good there that we actually see that is embedded already in law or the exercise of political authority. And I think once you accept that, once you realize, okay, there is a perverse understanding that can be embedded in law, the question isn't then, okay, so how do we exit that space? To me, the question is then, well, you need to redirect it. Because if you don't redirect it, I don't think you're going to be left untouched.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that I think that's right. And I think this keeps coming back to in my mind. My sticking point here is that I think I really struggle to imagine I really struggle with that kind of theory of political imagination, I guess, which is the whole point of this podcast. So maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
What do you mean? What do you mean? You struggle as in the you well, you find the
I just don't know what it would look like to encourage the state, given that it's almost like a Pandora's box, right? So with the creation of the nation state. So once you kind of create this apparatus, it almost goes on to autopilot, accumulating into itself, monopolizing both violence, but also claims on identity, that it wants to flatten out all identity to that of the citizen, rather than kind of the particularities of kind of cultural belonging and things like that. How do you stop that almost machine-like process of of monopolization?
Look, I think
the indigenous recognition stuff is so important here and so interesting here, because it's an example where you all of a sudden you have this pre-existing, I'd say polis within the nation state of Australia that is now asking for recognition of its own internal authority within itself. Mm. And it's fascinating to watch what happens when a modern nation state is asked to diffuse some of its sovereignty or recognizing authorities within itself other than its own authority.
Right. So what you've just said there, in ways, you know, it echoes, it has a reflection of, you know, if you even go back to some of that classical and medieval thinking, like Aquinas, right, talking about us as social animals. Mm. For Aquinas, he says that the political authority coordinates different units, right? So it says it coordinates units which he says have independent, genuinely independent powers of operation, mm. right? And so there's an understanding, even what you're saying, that political authority could be cast as something that facilitates something other than itself.
Yes.
Right? And other things in itself, but nevertheless oriented towards good ends, right? Yep. And I think that's kind of, you know, pushing towards that. You know, now principally, you know, how do you go about this? This is where, you know, Kavanaugh is brilliant, because, you know, he's very much about, you need to build sort of the ethical muscles of the church itself. You need to ground it in the solidarity and the gift that is Eucharistic life, and these sorts of arguments that you get punctuating throughout his work. And that's right, because you can't have an understanding of what does the political body look like when the church itself, if the church itself is not a political body, it's not a body that is, you know, rightly seeking God and these sorts of things. So, you know, that has a principal element to it, right? And even like Milbank and so on would agree on this, that you know, traditionally it's understood that when you're exhorting political authority, you're doing so from the basis of an exemplar society, a society that exists within itself, that has a more vigorous understanding of what is the needs, what is required by virtue.
Mm.
You know, so you do have that priority that takes place, but I think there has to be a much more layered approach to what that then entails for formation of what I've been calling a commonwealth, which is a complex understanding of a political society.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're just about out of time.
Well, we're well over time, aren't we?
Yeah, sorry about that. I think this is probably just going to keep happening until the lockdown's finished. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. This is kind of the first of two parts where we're looking at different essays. Next week, we're going to be looking at an essay that I haven't looked at for a long time, but I'm very interested for reasons I'll get into next week, called The Inner Ring by C.S. Lewis, which you can find in The Weight of Glory, if you've got your own copy. Yeah, it's a very easy read. So if you want to read that before next week, that would be fantastic. Please like us on Facebook. You can find us on Facebook where it is searching The Eucatastrophe. You can follow us on Twitter at UCAT, EUCAT underscore podcast. And please drop us a review on whatever platform you listen to us. That really helps us out. And recommend us to a friend if you find us at all interesting. And thanks so much for everyone who's been doing that kind of thing lately. And thanks so much for people's comments and the interesting discussion that some of our last episodes seem to have generated. Until next week, thanks so much, and we'll see you then.